Good afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. It's Monday, February 13th, 2012. Just for a point of clarity, because I know that you're here for a public hearing and work session on a number of bills, I will explain why we're having our confab back here. We will hear the public hearing and work session on House Bill 4167, and we will lay over House Bill 4168 and House Bill 4169. So if you're here for those two, they are being set over so that we can actually deal with some of the issues that are involved with those two bills. So with that, we will hear House Bill 4167 first.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Before you is House Bill 4167. There it is, to resolve some implementation issues with House Bill 2712 that came out of the 2011 legislative session. The packet before you includes the introduced version of the measure, legislative council explanatory memorandum, a preliminary fiscal impact and staff measure summary. The measure does not have a fiscal impact at this time. And there are three amendments. And legislative council, Dave Hendricks is here to walk through the measure and the three amendments, which are a dash three amendment, a dash six, and a dash seven amendment.
Mr. Hendricks.
No dash five.
We're in public hearing on this.
We're in public hearing.
Okay.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Nolan, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office. You should have my memo on House Bill 4167.
Yes.
And I don't think I'll go through that unless you have specific questions on it, but I will go through the three amendments since you don't have any explanatory material for that. The dash three amendments do just one thing. There were several provisions in the bill that are addressed in the memo that starting at section 12 at SEC, it's on pages 7 through 15 of the bill, that were changes that had been requested or been pointed out for possible changes by the Judicial Department with respect to maximum fines for certain offenses called specific fine offenses. And good examples of those would be like your snow park permit and some of the others where they're not within the classification system, the A, B, C, D violations that the great majority of offenses are under. And the existing law had those set at about at $2,000 if nothing else was specified. So you had sort of an anomaly in that you would have a snow park offense in which the ticket would be $30, but the maximum fine was $2,000. And so the thought was to go through and fix those by putting in maximum fines for each of those offenses that were more in line with the amount that went on the ticket. But there was some quite a bit of discussion about some of the other offenses that appeared in there and what the maximum fine should be. It's not a fix that has to be done at this time. We have an interim committee who is directed to follow the implementation of this. And what dash three would do would be basically set those decisions aside for the time being with respect to maximum fines for those offenses and let the interim committee. So they would come out of the bill. They would remain where they're at under the existing law. We would not change the maximum fine on these offenses and instead have the committee look at those, the policy committee look at those and decide whether what those maximum fines should be or if they need to be changed at all. I've advocated in the past that we ought to consider creating a Class E violation. For instance, we have Class A, B, C, and D. We need a small one to cover these small offenses where people, where you want to say the ticket's $30, maybe the maximum fine's $100 or $200. And that would, we could fit a lot of these right into that. The bill doesn't do that. It would be a good thing to consider during the interim. So that's the dash three. It would just take those out, boot them over to the interim, and let them look at the maximum fine for those offenses. The dash six amendments would exempt, 2712 had, you know, gotten rid of the unitary assessment, the county assessment, and other tack-ons to the bill and substituted a flat $60 payment from local courts that go back to the state for each of the offenses that replace that old mandatory unitary assessment, county assessment amounts. It's $60 on each offense, and it gets paid first. The problem that was raised with respect to that is that there are several of these small offenses, and they're listed there on lines 16 and 17 of the amendments. There are things like helmet violations, snow park violations, those sort of things where the fine amount that goes on the ticket is $30. So those tickets under the 2712 provision would actually, they would be required to send all of the money back from those tickets to the state for deposit. What the Dash 6 amendments do is exempt those particular offenses from the requirement of the $60 payment from the Justice and Municipal Courts. Circuit courts will continue to do that because it works easier for their computer system not to have to specially code for these. They will simply say, yeah, they're still subject to the $60, and they'll flow the same way they had before. But for the Justice and Municipal Courts, they would keep the $30 for at least these offenses. There's a couple of counties who are more affected than others by this. Apparently, Hood River County does a lot. The Justice Court there does a lot of these snow park permits, and so for them, it was a big deal. This will resolve that problem. The Dash 7 amendments addresses the issue that arose with relating to tickets that were issued for violation of TriMet ordinance, and we're primarily talking about the tickets for people riding TriMet without tickets, without paying the fare. And TriMet, of course, had back in December went on a project to up their enforcement efforts in this area. So according to the papers, hiring several more enforcement officers to try to deal with apparently a fairly serious problem with people not honoring the honor system, which they apparently were using. And they had been anticipating receiving a portion of those fines back, which would have been the case before 2712 passed. 2712, of course, got rid of a lot of dedicated fine provisions where small amounts of money were moving to different entities based on the type of the offense. And one of the thoughts was to put an end to that because it really did complicate the judicial department system where they had to say this particular fine goes to this person and sometimes even to have that amount dedicated for a specific purpose. And the example I've used that we did address in 2712 was a provision that said that every citation for refusal to take a breathalyzer, that the fine amounts went to the Oregon State Police and was only to be used for purposes of enforcing laws relating to driving under the influence. And that sounded great because it was kind of like the bad guys are going to be the ones funding it. But the total amount that they were getting every binding was like $200,000. But on the other hand, judicial department had to track it separately, had to deliver it to the department. They had to track it separately. We did backfill that amount in the bill through an allocation from the criminal fines account. But nevertheless, we got rid of that whole business of tracking it through the system. The TriMet ordinances was one where there was a provision that was repealed that did not appear to have much significance, but for TriMet it did because they were undergoing this increased enforcement. And so their request was is that we had amendments that would basically reinstate a structure for repayment of the amounts to TriMet, a portion of the amounts. The structure that is laid out in the Dash 7 amendments is very similar to the structure that we have for cities and counties that have police forces and who send tickets to circuit courts where the $60 goes to the CFA and the remaining balance is split between the state and the city or the county. So that structure gets them close, fairly close to where they were before with respect to the payments that they were receiving. So I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions about this or the bill.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Hendricks, a bill whose number now escapes me, emerged from the House Judiciary Committee. And my recollection is that it covered many of the areas that it sounds like these amendments are covering, not all, but most. Is that accurate? To what extent do the amendments cover that bill whose number escapes me?
Co-chair Winters, Representative Hicks. The TriMet provision was amended into 4025, although it's evolved since then.
4025.
And the provision here that's in the dash 6, the small fines, was also in 4025. So those are the pieces that are coming from 4025, which was printed A and gross today, coming out of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, thank you. Because there's still that bill hanging out there for consideration by this committee, and so the extent that we're reconciling here is, I think, important to recognize. And it sounds like so the pieces of 4025 that are not before us today would be, I remember, dropping from 60 to 45 was one of the sections of it. What else, to your recollection, is not?
The other significant piece that appeared in 4025 was a change in the they requested a change in the priority of application of payments on judgments, and that doesn't appear here either.
Okay.
4025 is still coming to the committee, of course, and I think the thought was these were pieces that
revenue neutral.
Yeah, frankly, I think it was primarily because these were ones that did not have significant fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Hendrick. We're under public hearing to Paul Snyder and Darryl Fuller. Why don't the two of you come up? You've both signed up.
The fiscal impact statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, appearing generally in support of House Bill 4167. We appreciate the addition of the Dash 6 amendments on the snow park violations and the helmet laws and others like that. We think that's an improvement. We like Section 7 of the bill, and one reason why I mention this is that we have another issue that we'd like to present to you. Section 7 changes how distributions would be made among the counties. It doesn't change the appropriation, it just changes how the pie is sliced. Among the counties of the court facilities fund, and provides that the calculation to determine each county's share will be based on contributions by all courts, by justice courts, by municipal courts, and by circuit courts, because those are the courts that are actually making the contributions, and the thought there is that distributions should be reflective of where the contributions are coming from, and they should also be somewhat reflective of the way things were distributed before House Bill 2712 was passed in 2011. So we think Section 7 is an improvement, and it would make things more appropriate in how distributions are made. After the bill was printed, actually late last week, it came to our attention that there's another provision in House Bill 2712 that has the same problem. And it has to do with distributions of funds for county juvenile and adult correctional facilities and programs. Once again, it's an appropriation. It doesn't change the appropriation. But the law in 2712 still says that a distribution should be based upon contributions from circuit courts only. And we think that does not reflect appropriately what distributions were before or what contributions have been made since. So we would suggest an amendment to House Bill 4167 to use very similar language to what appears in Section 7 already and apply it to that section of House Bill 2712, which is Section 58, sub 1, with regard to distributions for correctional facilities. Now, I understand from an exchange of emails between Legislative Council and the Judicial Department late last week that That calculation can be made by a formula rather than having to track all the contributions. And if indeed that's the case, then I think it can be done by the Department of Corrections without any difficulty. Although the language might have to be changed to say as determined by the Department of Corrections when it's applied to the correctional facility issue.
Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Paul, I'm looking at a handout that you gave me here a few minutes ago, and it talks about that you've had a conversation with Mr. Hendricks and with Mr. Borden.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Borden and I didn't discuss it directly with each other. I think Mr. Hendricks.
Oh, that's correct. As I read this, that is correct. And so I guess I would, Madam Co-Chair, I'd turn to Mr. Borden and say, my understanding is that any amendments need to be approved by the big co-chairs prior to us moving those forward. Is that your understanding?
Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Smith, that's correct. And this particular issue, you know, we've not seen any language on it, but this particular issue seemed more suitable for the interim committee to take a look at. I mean, that's what the interim committee is for, to evaluate the implementation of the measures. That committee could look at this issue, make sure it's sorted out properly, and then, as Ledge Council points out, there could always be a legislation introduced in early 2013 that would have a retroactive clause that would make any necessary corrections if that's what the interim committee found. So,
okay, just a follow-up question. So following that, Paul, would you be open to that, to work in the interim for that type of solution?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we work with anybody to fix the problem, but we prefer to do it sooner than later.
Sooner than later. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. I also had received correspondence from my commissioner and as well as my sheriff on the same issue. So the clarity is that if you can work with the interim, other than that, we would be delayed in getting approval from the co-chairs. Mr. Fuller.
Chairs, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As the folks that implement corrections at the county level, we agree with what he said. And in the interest of not taking up any more of your time, we're just here in support of the bill and the amendments and like I said, working with our partners in the county and trying to fix as many of these unintended consequences as we seem to be finding from 2712. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 4167? If not, I will close the public hearing and I will open a work session on House Bill 4167.
Madam Co-Chair, do you need a description or are you ready to roll?
I'm ready to roll.
Would you entertain a motion? Madam Co-Chair, I move that the committee adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 4167.
Representative Nolan moved that we adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 4167. Discussion. Is there any objections? Adopted.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
I move that we adopt the -6 amendment to House Bill 4167.
Co-Chair Nolan moved that we adopt the -6 amendments to House Bill 4167. Discussion? Objection? Moved.
Madam Co-Chair, just because we're on a roll, I move that we adopt the -7 amendment to House Bill 4167.
Co-Chair Nolan moved that we adopt the -7 amendments to House Bill 4167. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Adopted.
Madam Co-Chair, I think our work on this bill is done, and I will move House Bill 4167
as amended three times to the full committee on full joint committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Co-chair Nolan moved House Bill 4167 as amended to the full Ways and Means Committee be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Geez. Thank you.
You run a tight ship, Madam Co-chair. I'd be happy to carry that at full.
You are so welcome.
Be the Senate carrier.
Would you like to carry that?
I'd be happy to carry it on the Senate floor.
Senator Monroe would be very happy to carry it on the Senate floor.
I'll just listen to whatever Nolan says, and I'll just do as well.
I hope you keep that as a regular directive.
Yeah, you're sure.
Of course.
Thank you.
Opening a work session on military department report on Christmas Valley. Quit playing with your iPhone.
Ooh, busted.
Busted, yeah.
I don't know whether she was directing that to you or me.
I'm just going to squeeze in another email before the next event.
General.
Madam
Brigadier
Chairman,
General.
Co-chair,
yes.
For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department and also the Interim Head of the Office of Emergency Management. As directed by the legislature, we've been asked to report to you on our efforts at Christmas Valley and what we're how things are going at this stage of the game. And today I intend to do that for you. As you recall, this is a former backscatter radar site located in Christmas Valley. It was owned and operated by the Air Force. In early 2007, it became obvious that there was that the backscatter horizon radar was going to be disbanded. Actually, it was 2006. And we sought to acquire 2,622 acres that we originally looked at for F-15 pilot training, which we do all of the F-15 pilot training now for the United States Air Force and the Air Guard out of Klamath Falls. So all F-15 pilots have to go through there. Right above that site, the Christmas Valley site, is what is known as a military operating airspace, which we control, and we train over that airspace clear down to not virtually, you know, a few hundred feet above the ground. And so that was the plan was and still is that we would use mobile threat emitters to move out on that site and place at different places to produce electronic signatures to pilots who have to learn how to avoid surface-to-air missiles and other things that can come from the ground and other aspects. So that was our original idea. As we looked at the site, it became obvious to us that this is located in a high desert flat and had a tremendous amount of infrastructure that was put in there for this backscatter radar, which was a Cold War relic. And that site offered a significant amount of energy that was coming into it to run that radar setup, up to 100 megawatts of total power lines coming into the site. So after the radar was, and after the Air Force has spent approximately $275 million to put that site in, and the technology became obsolete as the time went on, and the need was no longer there. So in the 2005 BRAC, the base realignment and closure process, they abandoned the site. We worked with the Air Force at that time to see if we could get it directly transferred to us. We could not. But the infrastructure still intrigued us with respect to the capability of maybe looking at long-term investments, not only for the training that we wanted, but also to create some revenue and some replacement energy for the amount of energy that we use in the Oregon National Guard. We were able to obtain 326 acres on the site in 2009 through a Federal Emergency Management Agency conveyance, and our plan was there's three major warehouses on the our storage buildings, large storage buildings on the site, and our plan was and still is part of our overall response planning for emergency management to use that site to house equipment and or structures that could be moved out of there quickly by helicopter to a high-impacted area. We're thinking specifically of the Cascadia event, that if it happens, it's probably going to be pretty much up and down the coast, and we needed a site inland that wouldn't be impacted where we could go take CH-47 helicopters, load up 10 each, other types of structures or anything else, and then fly it to the affected areas, thinking more than likely that most airports will be destroyed on the coast and we won't be able to get our bigger airplanes, Air Force airplanes in, or Air Guard airplanes. So we were able to get that conveyance of 326 acres and the infrastructure that's there to include several wells and the current electric program or electricity that's already in, three substations, only one of which is operational. So we thought that was a good deal for the state, and it was also, good planning for the future. At the same time, we learned that the General Services Administration would pick up the remaining 2,296 acres, and they offered that to us at an unreasonable price to purchase it from them. So we declined that. We kept in conversation with the Department, with the General Services Administration, and since then have been able to negotiate the price down considerably. We still have not made a purchase sale agreement because of we just aren't prepared to do that. We are developing, the department is developing an energy security plan, and really is predicated on renewable energy potential and Christmas Valley being a part of that. This has been a central part mission statement of the Department of Defense for the last several years. Federal emphasis coincides with the Oregon Legislature's mandate to invest 1.5% of all construction projects into solar energy development. We with your approval, are attempting to maximize these investments by developing a goal and to reduce, if not eliminate, our total consumption, you know, from the typical grid utility that we have. Additionally, we think it's clear that developing an energy security project for Christmas Valley through the abandoned infrastructure, we would save significant tax dollars in the long term. At present, in addition to constructing the 150-kilowatt program that we just completed on our top of our buildings down at the site, we have completed an interconnection agreement with BPA and Midstate Electric, which is the co-op utility firm that services that area, for a 20-megawatt project. And in partnership with the Oregon Institute of Technology and the Oregon Department of Energy, we're developing a feasibility study to see if a utility-scale energy development on this site can be accomplished in the near term. That study should be completed in the next 90 days. We've also worked with Treasure Valley Community College, who, as you may recall from previous testimony I've done before this committee, that we have an armory adjacent to the campus in Ontario, where we've also have a major development of four different types of solar energy that we've put in there to see what we can do to maximize as we develop further energy project, which one works best for us. Treasure Valley, in the meantime, wants to have a training environment for a photovoltaic installation, maintenance and monitoring, and actually have a classroom sitting on the Christmas Valley site. And study if we are able to get a utility-sized developer in there. As for the price, again, of the property, GSA has priced it at $1,103,699 for the total acquisition. That price, as we understand it, to offer to us is good until March of 2015. And we also but we have to complete the business model, which we haven't done yet. Our business model would incorporate, however, as we develop it, develop the land of purchase cost, that purchase cost to be rolled into that business model to pay for that, and or lease agreement for land on this utility-scale project. Any amount of revenue identified over the land cost would then be used to offset the energy consumption statewide. Over a long period of time, we think it will pay us great dividends to do that. Our costs right now for the Oregon Army National Guard, not the Air Guard, currently we're putting out on an annual basis over $2 million in federal monies and $1.5 million in state monies to pay for electricity for our operations. The Air Guard consumes about an equal amount of energy. Right now, our total consumption of electricity is around 40 megawatts annually. So where are we at now? Currently, the economic conditions, the loss of some federal and state tax credits have impacted the ability to find a full developer of the project. We've had multiple entities approach us with varying levels of interest, but we've received no firm commitments as of yet. We intend to secure an agreement with developers prior to finalizing any purchase agreement with the GSA. And we're also working with the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Energy, who's going to be here in Oregon next week. We intend to talk to her about what could the Department of Defense bring in to get this kick-started with a 10 or 20 megawatt, preferably 20 megawatt, which would cover all of the Army National Guard's costs or energy costs, and actually develop that and be the anchor, which would be our preference, but that might be a long shot. Our team at the military department is currently in the process of reevaluating all the long-term prospects of the development and of that site. We intend to have that completed by sometime either in the summer or fall and know fully where we stand and what the possibility is if we can take it further. In the meantime, we still desire to get the property for our F-15 training, whether or not we're able to maximize this or not with respect to the energy production. So that might add that I also, the Oregon National Guard, the Army has come up with a program called Net Zero, which is they're trying to get to net zero in the next 10 years to cut their costs and its energy security, which, as we all know, that's why we spend billions and billions of dollars to keep the oil flowing out of the Middle East. We've done several things. We've got projects at Camp Rialia that are smaller, but this net zero project is basically designed to look at all types of energy. We submitted a proposal to become part of this net zero plan with the Army. There were several other National Guard entities that submitted. We were the only one selected in the entire country, along with about six other major Army bases. And our proposal was a little different than the average one. They were talking about specific sites like one camp, Camp Withicum, Camp Rialia, something like that. We submitted a concept called Fort Oregon, and we looked at all of our armories, and we looked at all of our camps and all of our bases, and we were selected due in large part to that bigger look and some of the things that we are already doing. Because we've got projects, Camp Withicum, St. Helens, this is solar, Gresham Armory, Ontario, which I mentioned, a little bit at Christmas Valley that I mentioned. We're also doing some things at Polk County as we complete that project. We have a small wind generator sitting at Camp Rialia that we're studying the information that we're getting off of that. And we're also looking at wave energy off of Camp Rialia right on the Oregon coast. So that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have pertaining to this subject.
Mr. Bort.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair and members of the committee. In September 2010, the Emergency Board directed the department to report to the appropriate policy committees and Joint Ways and Means during the 2011 session with a detailed business case, financial analysis and plan, and feasibility studies related to Christmas Valley and how the project is of military use. The military department still does not have a detailed business case, financial analysis, and plan for the project, and therefore is unable to comply with the budget note. I would just note a couple things from our analysis. The first is that the department itself notes that it is delayed plans to actually purchase the Christmas Valley site at the present time, that its leadership team is currently in the process of reevaluating the long-term prospects for the development of Christmas Valley site and will be prepared to provide a report to the 2013 legislature. In at least one feasibility study that has been completed that was dated December 2011, it raised questions about the financial viability of the project, some of the quality of the water on the site, and the usefulness of the site for a military purpose. And I would conclude by saying, by reiterating one of the directions of the September Emergency Board, and that is that while the department has the authority to acquire land for military purposes, the statutory authority, that when it comes to this particular project, the Emergency Board's direction is that it will, its other funds accounts, rather than the general fund, will bear all risk for the project. So with that, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would respectfully disagree that the 2011 report was a draft report. It isn't a final report. And if it says different than that, and it wasn't a stamped draft, then that's our fault. Because I've been told explicitly by the folks that we have working that program that is drafted and had some issues in it that needed to be resolved before it could be finalized, which is why I said it would be done in the 90 days.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for staff. So was this other funds, it was entirely other funds involved here?
Mr. Borden.
Co-Chair and Representative Hicks, the department has two primary sources of other funds. One is Armory rental revenue, which is rental revenue from the various armories across the state. And the other is its capital construction account, which is essentially the proceeds from the sale of military property. So neither account is generally substantial. Armory rental revenues are in the neighborhood of $3 million, and the capital construction account varies significantly with the sale of property.
What's the feasibility, given the state of the economy and what have you, of the sale of property?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, presently right now we have a couple of small pieces of property that are not valued in very great quantities that we would dispose of if there was a market to do that, but that's about it. There is no significant properties for sale. We have restate that. We have two armories in the Portland area since we completed the construction of the armory at Camp Withicum, one in Lake Oswego, one in Tigard. We're currently working with some both, because they both have different arrangements back when they were originally constructed with local government, that if we don't use them anymore, then they revert back to the local government. And the other one in Tigard's a little different. That's pretty much Lake Oswego. We're in negotiations now with both those entities to see where we sit in this process. And presently, there's not a hot market for any type of property, particularly that sort of property. It's just not a very good market presently.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, I might add that the I'm sorry. Did you have a question? Okay. I might add that the when you look at what's occurred with federal tax credits, state tax credits with respect to these types of developments, developers are all over the map, which has been difficult to try to pin down exactly how we would approach this thing based on, we had hoped by now that we would have had somebody come in and make us a substantial proposal that we could then bring to you and say, here is the proposal. Our intention has been all along to get somebody else to pay for this land acquisition costs. But right now that's just not a really hot item based on those factors.
Co-Chair Nolan. No.
You want a motion?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. Madam Co-Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report with instructions that the department report to the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means or the E-Board during September 2012, on whether it has chosen to proceed with a property purchase, and if so, to submit the requested detailed business plan and financial analysis and plan.
Thank you. And before, I only have one question, and whether or not the September 2012 is a reasonable deadline or timeline for you.
Madam Chair, that pretty much coincides with where we're at right now, as I indicated in my testimony, is that once this feasibility study is completely vetted out and we know exactly what it says, then we'll have an opportunity to see what is possible. But until we get them and the potential suitors, same place, same time, we're just guessing.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? No objection.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'll carry whatever you need.
Thank you.
Any further discussion for the good of the order? If not, we are adjourned. Adjourned. If not, we are